It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, Vermont is poised to become the first state in the U.S. to require GMO food labeling. We'll get your take as well.
First, climate scientists and meteorologists from across the world are predicting that 2014 could see the development of an El Nino climate pattern.
And our guest next says that if these forecasts are any indication, it's going to be a big one. It could end up being the biggest global weather story of 2014. But what exactly is El Nino, and how will we know if it happens?
Joining us now to explain the climate phenomenon is Eric Holthaus, Viroqua-based meteorologist who writes about weather and climate for Slate's Future Tense. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's get a refresher course first. What is El Nino?
Sure. So El Nino is the tropical Pacific Ocean. So that's the area of the Pacific Ocean right around the equator. Every 3 to 7 years or so gets a little bit warmer than normal. And we haven't had one of these major El Ninos since the 97-98 one. And if you watch Saturday Night Live, that's the Chris Farley one where he dressed up in a big suit with a tornado in the background. So
right, he said, "I am El Nino," Spanish for or English for the Nino.
Yeah, exactly.
We remember it well. And is it coming back? Is that what's about to happen here?
Yeah. So what we have right now is there's a large shift in warm water beneath the surface of the Pacific Ocean right now, and that's just starting to come up to the surface to where we can start to, we'll start over the next few months to start to have an impact on global weather patterns. But by any indication of the buoys and the sensors that we have looking at the data now, the trend is towards one of, about the scale of that one in 1997-98, which caused a lot of trouble around the world.
So how reliably can we predict an El Nino year?
Well, that's a great question. This is the time of the year that is typically known for having the least predictability. So it's still kind of up in the air whether this is going to happen or not. But the difference is this year, the models are pretty much unanimous that that it's going to happen. So, you know, you still have kind of that outside chance that that things could change. But we do have a lot of information on this particular event that the pattern should play out.
And if the models are right and we do have an El Nino year coming up, when does it start and what sorts of weather patterns should we look for first?
Sure, yeah. So the good news is that in the U.S., strong El Ninos in particular have a great chance of bringing fewer hurricanes than normal on the East Coast. And also they can have to bring above normal rainfall for the drought area in California. For people in Wisconsin, the great news is that the upcoming winter may be a little bit warmer and less snowy than normal, especially given the last couple of winters that we've had in a row now of a lot of snow. We still have snow in our front yard here from the other day. So
yeah,
we grew up with, so
it's tempting to say hallelujah to that and leave it there, but it's not all good news. But at least, you know, in Wisconsin here, we might want a milder winter, but what happens to the summers?
Sure. Yeah, and that's kind of really the biggest part of this El Nino is that the big El Ninos in particular have a tendency to raise temperatures worldwide by a few tenths of a degree. And, you know, that might not sound like much, but over the last 30 or 40 years, we've had a trend of about 8 tenths of a degree warming attributed to climate change. And if you can bump that up a little bit, it's just going to exacerbate those effects that we've been feeling around the world from climate change.
Now, I think in Wisconsin, a lot of us here figure that we've pretty much paid in blood for the winter we have. And so we deserve a really nice summer that's not sweltering, that's, you know, in the 80s moderate. Is that what an El Nino will deliver, or is it something different?
Yeah, well, the El Nino normally forms in the fall months. So over the next 3 or 4 months will just be the establishment of the pattern, and the effects won't really kick in until sometime this fall and really peak in the winter. So effects on the summer here in Wisconsin are not going to be really that detectable from the El Nino pattern. But, you know, yeah, we can cross our fingers that this year will be a little bit cooler than it has been the last couple of years.
Now, if it is an El Nino year kicking in the fall, what do we know about some of the things that could happen, say, to food prices?
Yeah, that's a concern, is that there are places where if, like California, that's experiencing the drought, like the Southern Plains that grows a lot of cattle and there are places that are dealing with droughts, and that if that pattern doesn't kick in, that even strong El Niños sometimes don't bring the rain to California and some of those places that are dealing with the big drought. So if that doesn't happen, those places are about at their limit as far as how much that they can handle increased dryness. So any further lack of rainfall is really going to hit food prices. That'll ripple across the country, I think.
Are there ways that we can prepare for an El Nino year?
There are things that some countries are doing. So generally in the Pacific, countries in the Pacific like Australia, Indonesia, Peru are the countries that get hit hardest by El Nino. And so there's very predictable effects on those kind of countries. And so there's one example of in Manila in the Philippines, they have water managers that control the input of stream flow into their main reservoir that feeds the city there. And they've been using El Nino forecasts for the last 10 years or so to guide and make that that process a little bit more efficient. So there are places in the world that do have predictability, even better than the Midwest of the U.S., that they rely on these kind of forecasts to plan months in advance.
Well, and you mentioned Australia. I understand that fighting fires is something that can get pretty intense in an El Nino year in Australia.
Yeah, exactly. So Australia in particular has been dealing with a rash of hot summers and dry summers over the last couple of years. So and that would trend towards continuing if there's an El Nino.
Do we know exactly what it is that causes an El Nino?
Yeah, I think that the science is getting a little bit better on this, but if you imagine the Pacific Ocean as like a giant bathtub, there is some sloshing that happens on a 3 to 5 to 10 year time period. And that has to do a lot with the El Nino cycle. So there is, a lot of times there's a response, that takes a few years to play out. And so we've put buoys a few hundreds of feet below the surface of the ocean to detect those kind of sloshes. And that's kind of what the theory is right now that causes the El Nino, is just this kind of oscillation back and forth on the east and west side of the Pacific Ocean. You know, the Pacific Ocean covers almost half the planet. So this is going to have impacts that extend well beyond just that region of the planet.
Now, you mentioned that this summer will continue on in the existing weather pattern. If there is an El Nino, we'll start to feel the effects in the fall. So is it possible to look ahead to next summer and forecast what Wisconsin might experience in, I guess, 2015?
Sure, yeah. And that's when, if we do have a strong El Nino, then we're gonna start to feel the effects of the increasing temperature worldwide. So, yeah, you just have that slight bump up in the odds of having one of those really hot summers for next summer, if it does play out the way the forecasts are right now.
Well, Eric, thanks so much for coming on and explaining El Nino to us again.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We've been talking to Eric Holthaus. He's a Viroqua-based meteorologist who writes about weather and climate for Slate's Future Tense.
Yesterday, Vermont State Senate passed a bill that will require labeling of all genetically modified foods sold in that state.
If the bill is signed into law by Vermont's governor, the state will become the first state in the nation to enact a law like that.
Mark Castell is joining us. He's co-founder of the Cornucopia Institute. He's joining us to explain GMO labeling and what it may mean for consumers and producers. Mark, thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. The Vermont bill requires that all foods containing GMO ingredients should be labeled. Is that good news for Vermont in your mind?
I think that's good news for Vermont, and this could be the first fissure in the foundation of Monsanto and the other biotechnology giants, which would mean it would be good news for the rest of the country, including Wisconsin citizens who'd like a choice in what they eat.
And it'll be the first in the nation to adopt such a law. Do you think there will be a domino effect in that way?
Well, it could be. This isn't that radical. There are 60 countries, including the European Economic Union, the second largest economy out there, that already mandate labeling. This isn't a new trend. There's been two citizens' initiatives in California and Washington that just marginally lost after the agribusiness and biotech industries dumped tens of millions of dollars on trying to convince consumers that they don't deserve the chance to choose what's in their food. So right now there are 23 states where this is at some stage in the legislative process. There are three states that have current ballot initiatives in the works. And the biotech industry is fighting back because they really know what's at stake here. When consumers have a choice, as they do in Europe, they tend to not want to have a grand experiment perpetrated, carried out on their children when we haven't really thoroughly studied these materials in the laboratory yet.
Well, I think I read that in Vermont, the state is actually setting aside funding to pay for the lawsuits that they anticipate coming their way. Do you anticipate that, too? And if so, I mean, is that something that deters states from taking action like this?
Well, yes and yes. And one question, operative question here, is this the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning? It's likely that Monsanto or some other very wealthy, well-endowed corporation will challenge this. I'll remind listeners that in the mid-1990s, when the very first genetically modified organism was commercialized in our food supply, and that was BGH, bovine growth hormone, manufactured by Monsanto, and fought very vigorously by our former Senator Russ Feingold, even though the FDA at the time said they wouldn't require mandatory labeling, even though the public seemed in a majority to want it, they would allow, quote, voluntary labeling as long as it was not misleading or untruthful, end quote. And so there is a higher power than the government in these issues, and that's the corporation. So Monsanto sued Swiss Valley Farms, a co-op, farmer-owned co-op in Iowa that sells milk here in Wisconsin, because they had the audacity to put signs up to say, it's our policy not to accept milk treated with BGH. They didn't say, and they were sued by Monsanto for defamation. Nothing on their sign talked about cancer or deleterious health impacts. It just said our policy is not to accept it. So it won't be surprising if these well-heeled corporations decide to challenge the state. They're probably intelligent. It was probably an intelligent choice to set aside funding. It's quite unfortunate, but that's the reality that we work in today.
Mm-hmm. Let's explain for people who may not be aware, what does GMO stand for and why is this a concern to some people?
That's a good question. It's a genetically modified organism or genetically engineered organism. These are living species, plants or animals or bacterium, including yeasts that are used in our foods, that never have existed on Earth before. They're generally produced through recombinant gene splicing. They're generally transgenic, meaning that they're taking, it's not the traditional plant breeding where we take two tomato plants and try to combine traits. They're taking species that have no relationship to each other and splicing them together. Right now, the majority of all of our soybeans and corn sugar beets, canola, a number of other, which is rapeseed, a number of other crops in this country are genetically modified. And in most cases, they're genetically mutated to resist a patented brand of herbicide that Monsanto makes that would normally kill the plant. In some cases, there is a pesticide spliced right into the plant, a bacterium. But these plants also have antibiotics as part of the process spliced in. And we're not just changing the genetic traits that we're interested in that have economic value. The existing genome of the cultivars become mutated in unpredictable ways. So we're creating these life forms that we've released out into the population or out into the environment. And we have the human population eating these for just a micro blip in terms of human evolution. So we really don't know what the long-term implications are going to be for the environment or human health.
Have we seen any short-term implications?
Well, there are some disturbing studies that indicate abnormal organ growth. There are some very, very few studies have been conducted outside of those done by the companies themselves. Independent research has been stymied and blocked legally in many cases. And almost all the studies have just been during a 30 or 90-day duration. When they have done studies that have been for the life of the laboratory animals, some of them have showed very, very disturbing outcomes. So we really don't know what's happening. We know that these genetically modified traits, like these bacterium, are found in the bloodstream of fetuses. We know that some of these pass through our digestive tracts. They've changed the microbiome in our own digestive system that now contain genetically modified organisms in our own body. We know they're found in waterways and the soil. So again, these have been commercialized for a very, very short period of time. The long-term implications are really unknown.
Hmm. Well, on the other hand, some say that GMO products actually help produce more food. They keep it cheap. And ultimately, some say that in the U.S. say that this is a very food-secure country because of it. What's your response to that?
Well, there are no genetically modified organisms out there that really produce more food right now. Most of the advances since they've come out in terms of productivity or yield, crop yield, are attributed to the traditional breeding techniques that are used for the same seeds that are genetically engineered. In fact, in some crops, like soybeans, there has been research to show, quote, yield drag, that the GMOs actually produce less. So we're not really sure who these benefit. Right now, there are no GMOs on the market here in the United States that produce more nutritious food, more flavorful food. The price of seeds have risen exponentially for farmers. So it's really questionable if the benefits to society are really there at this point.
On the other hand, in terms of nutrition, are GMO foods any less valuable nutritionally, or is it a zero-sum difference?
I haven't seen any science, any published research to suggest that there's any lesser nutritional level. We generally are suffering in the last 70 years through industrial agriculture. All of our food, with the exception of organic food, has lost a tremendous amount of nutritional value. The USDA replicated a study in, I think, 1990 that was originally performed. It might be 1999 that was originally performed in 1950 and looked at essential nutrients in our food, essential nutrients. About a third of them went down, as much as a third each. And so through the kind of mass production with less concentration on building the fertility of the soil and more dependence on chemical fertilizers, we've seen a general deterioration in the nutrient value of our food, not just the genetic engineered food.
Well, in our last minute before we hit the news break, is there a simple way for consumers to tell here in Wisconsin whether there are GMO ingredients in their food?
Right now, the only sure bet is to seek out certified organic food, because Genetic engineering is banned throughout the process, from the seed through processing ingredients to your table. So that's the safest way, and that might include growing your own food out in your own garden to be more economical, fresher, and higher in terms of nutrient value. There's nothing beats growing your own, but you want to make sure you're starting with seed that's genetically pured. So probably buying certified organic seed is your best bet.
Okay. We're talking with Mark Castell. He's co-founder of the Cornucopia Institute. We're talking about GMO labeling and why it might be becoming a requirement in the state of Vermont.
And we'd like to hear from you. Should Wisconsin, do you think, adopt a similar law? Do you feel you have a right to know if there are GMO products in your food? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org.
The Vermont State Senate passed a bill requiring the labeling of all products containing GMO ingredients. We're asking if this is a good move that should be implemented across the country, including Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear your take on the issue. Do you think all food products containing GMO ingredients should be labeled by law? And do you worry about genetically modified foods? Why or why not? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us to talk@wpr.org. You can also chime in on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our guest is Mark Castell. He is co-founder of the Cornucopia Institute, a farm policy research group. And Mark, let's talk to a caller here, John in Pleasant Prairie. Hi, John.
Hi there.
What's your comment?
You hear me okay?
Yep, go ahead.
I wanted to comment on, I think it definitely is consumers' right to know what's in the food, whether GMOs be a bad thing or a good thing. I think it's people's right to know. And I mean, I think the precautionary principle, and you know, that's been completely lost. We just reproduce these things, and that's no problem. But on the other side of the coin, I think, like you said, buying organic is really our only option in the meantime. I'd kind of like a greater transparency with organics as well, because a lot of times they'll have natural pesticides, but sometimes those can be just as bad or worse as the synthetic ones. So it'd almost be better labeling where you'd know exactly what pesticides are being used. I mean, there's natural pesticides such as rodenone that are, from what I hear, nearly as bad, from what I've researched, nearly as bad as some of the synthetic stuff. So I guess greater transparency all around with our food, I support that entirely.
Thanks, John. Thanks so much. Mark, what's your response to that? A couple of points there that we can hit.
Sure. Well, transparency is good. And the organic system is very transparent because we have federal law behind it. There's only one standard. Rotenone is a botanically based pesticide. So, first of all, it's very expensive to use botanicals versus chemical insecticides. So, organic farmers first rotate their crops and use other cultural practices that have fallen out of favor in conventional farming to eliminate the need for insecticides. But when they need them, they use naturally based. Rotenone is no longer legal for organics, not because there was any danger in the food or in the environment, but to the applicators. There's a relationship between Parkinson's, like many of the chemical insecticides, and rotenone for the farmers involved. But the natural pesticides break down very quickly in the environment, unlike some of the persistent synthetic agrochemicals. So we constantly are reviewing organic methods and making sure they're safe for the environment, for human health, and making sure they're actually essential in organic production.
Thanks for that question, John, or that comment. Gwen in Madison is next. Gwen, what's your comment?
I think that I heard, and I don't know if I'm right about this, that Monsanto breeds their seeds to prevent it from reproducing itself, or they engineer the seed so that it won't be viable when the plant produces seeds. Those seeds can't be planted the next year. They just, if you have corn or whatever, that means you have to buy a new crop of seed every year. Farmers used to store part of their seed and plant that the following year. Now they become dependent on Monsanto, and in India, I heard this was linked to severe indebtedness, especially if the crops don't produce as well as they're supposed to, and farmers have to buy a lot of seed every year. They end up in a great deal of debt, and that has been linked to farmer suicide. So it seems like Monsanto is just, I mean, we might not know the biological impact, but the social impacts don't seem very good either.
Thanks, Gwen. Mark?
Well, Gwen and your other callers are very well informed. But it's the fact that you can't save seed in many different cultivars and plant species like corn is not just linked to genetic engineering, but basically in the hybrids, you have to buy new seeds every year unless you're planting open pollinated or kind of classically bred seed, which some farmers do and it's still available. But in other crops like soybeans where you could save seed, Monsanto has a technology agreement that farmers have to sign to protect their intellectual property rights. They're basically patenting these life forms. And if a farmer saves seeds, Monsanto could go after them and sue them, which they've done, even in cases where genetic pollution has allegedly contaminated the crop of a farmer who did not buy their seed. When Monsanto's found their genetics in seed, they've gone after farmers, and this has gone all the way up to the Supreme Court. We've been a plaintiff in this. We haven't prevailed so far. We think that's a pretty draconian way to treat farmers and protect economic interest.
Mark in Cuba City is on the line. Mark, what's your question?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am not an organic farmer. I'm just a conventional farmer. And in my neck of the woods here, we have several organic farmers. And where I spray my chemical, there's a 15-foot barrier that they place on their pastures or their crops. Well, on a day like today when the wind's blowing, I'm not spraying. But I don't really understand where that 15-foot barrier is enough to protect anything.
Well, thanks for your call, Mark. You're right. Organic farmers have to plant a buffer zone. It's very unfortunate that the farmer that's not spraying chemicals has to go to the economic sacrifice of creating that zone to protect themselves. And you're also right that it's your responsibility to make sure there isn't, quote, overspray. And so you're being conservative and not spraying when it's windy. Not all farmers do that. It would be illegal to have a chemical trespass on your neighbor's farm. So we all of us who live in rural Wisconsin need to be respectful of our neighbors as best as possible.
And we'll take one last call from Howard in Laval. Howard, what do you have to say?
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having my call here. Just out of observation, I know we've been eating, the general U.S. population has been eating Roundup Ready soybeans since 1996. And I still, to date, I guess I've not seen any scientific research or concern from any medical college or community regarding, you know, the consumption of genetically modified product, and is that not enough of a time period to find anything? You'd think something would show up by then, and since 96. And about over 95% of our soybeans are genetically modified.
So 18 years, is that enough time?
Not really. In terms of the amount of time humans have evolved to eat food, that doesn't even show up. There is a growing body of peer-reviewed published science that does indeed lead us to have concerns about this technology. And one of your prior callers referred to the, quote, precautionary principle. That, in terms of regulation, is how Europeans approach food safety, that until you can conclusively prove a material is safe, it's not allowed in the food supply. Because of the domination by corporate money and its influence in our government, we do it a little bit different. You can have a material like an artificial sweetener, like sodium saccharin, in our food supply for decades. And then it takes a lot of effort to overcome corporate-sponsored science to prove that, in that case, it was actually carcinogenic. And then it finally gets pulled. Do you want your kids to be human lab rats and then find out 20 years down the line that we shouldn't have approved these materials? And in the meantime, many families are practicing the precautionary principle on their own by choosing organics.
Well, you've outlined some of the challenges that are standing between, I guess, the U.S. government and the effort among your group and others to label GMOs and to even get them out of the food supply. Where do you see this headed, though?
Well, I think we're going to see more fights on the state level. Obviously, that's gained traction. But as we succeed as citizens, the moneyed interests seem to always have their own game plan. And right now there's legislation being introduced in Congress that will preempt individual states from passing food laws in terms of GMO labeling that would give individual states the right, citizens the right to choose. And that will only happen on a federal level. Just as in this state, we've seen our legislature preempt local governments from controlling toxic chemicals that are particularly dangerous because of their ground structure for, in the karst regions of Wisconsin, or preventing factory farms from operating, or we have windmill siting. We've prevented many local governments. Now that trend is shifting to the federal government. It looks like as soon as citizens are going to flex their muscles, the U.S. Congress might undo that.
Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. You have a really fast-paced and interesting show. I enjoy it as a listener. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you. That was Mark Castell, co-founder of the Cornucopia Institute.
It's an understatement to say that Wisconsin's known for its beer. Some of the nation's most well-known brews are products of Wisconsin, and the microbrewing scene is exploding in popularity. But arguably Wisconsin's most iconic beer of all time, Pabst Blue Ribbon, has for years been unable to call Wisconsin home.
Well, a new group is trying to change that. When recent reports suggested that the California-based owner of Pabst is looking to sell the company, a group of Milwaukee residents got together with a goal in mind: bring Pabst Brewing Company back to the city it was born in. And so the Bring Pabst Blue Ribbon Home movement was born. And they'd like to see Milwaukee buy the company and adopt a community ownership model similar to that of the Green Bay Packers.
We've got two of the group's organizers with us now, Nikolai Chacho and Erica Wolf. Nikolai, hello to you.
Hi, thanks so much for having us on.
And Erica, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thanks so much.
So, Nikolai, let's start with you. Let's get some background. Milwaukee was home to Pabst Brewing for a long time. When did that change?
So, well, it depends on what you mean by home. That's a question that's fundamentally based on two different things. One is ownership, and one is operations. So it was brewed in Milwaukee for a very long time, and in a sense, it's still brewed here. PBR is currently a brand that, and most of the brewing is done under contract as Miller Coors. So it's still brewed here at Miller Coors breweries.
And now there are reports that the current owner is looking to sell Pabst, and that's where your group comes in. Why advocate for Pabst to come back to Milwaukee?
Yeah, so things began, I guess there are two separate stories here. And one story is the history of Milwaukee over the long period. I think one of the most important lessons that we can take from Milwaukee's history is that jobs and capital have been really fluid. They've come into the city and they've also left the city without much sort of anchoring. And so thinking about these issues, the question came up, how do we anchor jobs to the city? How do we anchor ownership to the city so that the benefits of ownership are something that is dispersed amongst residents locally? But then the other story is how this project got started, which was very simple. One morning I was reading about how Pabst, the current owners of Pabst were thinking about selling, and the idea popped up. Well, Pabst is from Milwaukee. Why doesn't Milwaukee own it? It's a new kind of novel idea, large-scale community ownership, but it's also a very exciting idea, and it's one we've been happy to participate in. So I started the Facebook page, and, you know, the rest just sort of caught on like wildfire, and people immediately started liking the page, and we got contacted by various media sources, and the discussion has blown up since then. Very exciting.
Well, let's talk to Eric a little bit about this. So it's been the issue has blown up, getting a lot of support in Milwaukee. As far as the plan for bringing PAPS, the ownership, to Milwaukee, Erica, can you flesh that out a little bit more? How would that work exactly, and do you think it could actually happen?
Well, I mean, I think of course anything's possible. I mean, when we think creatively about the economic situation we face in the city of Milwaukee and all over this country, that I think it's really important that we're thinking creatively and innovatively about how to bring the money, the immense wealth of this country, to benefit the public good. And so a big part of this project is obviously thinking about how to finance the purchase. I mean, PAPS Brewing Company is not a small company. So when we think about lots of other ways that we raise money for new projects, we think about sales tax. This is an option people have brought up to us. You talk about municipal bonding. You talk about angel investors. There's a lot of options about how we put together the money to make a sale. But ultimately, you know, as I'm sure you all know from following the story briefly, you know, we've sent letters to the city of Milwaukee's mayor and our alder people, and we had residents from all 15 districts in the city sign those letters, as well as people all over Wisconsin and all over the country. And then we've also sent a letter to the owners of the company, both of the CEOs and ultimately the purchaser of the company. And we've asked all of these folks to sit down with us to seriously consider this idea. And so, you know, we're sort of transitioning from capturing the excitement that came with the idea and funneling this into a serious negotiated sale where we're talking with major donors, talking about municipal ownership, and ultimately about how the public has democratic oversight of the revenue that comes in from the purchase of the company.
And how do you see Milwaukee benefiting from this, maybe even in terms of jobs and what types of jobs would come to the area?
Well, yeah, and thank you for asking that, because, you know, we really see this, you know, in addition to being about public ownership and about benefiting the common good, this is also about corporate responsibility. And we see that if we're in a leadership role, you know, those of us who have been keeping this project alive and doing these interviews, and also the people who have responded, you know, the thousands of people who have responded saying, you know, they'd like to buy a share. You know, we really are interested in making sure that PAPS is a company that is corporate, you know, has ethics of corporate responsibility. So we're talking about living wage jobs. We're talking about union brewery jobs. You know, we would like to see the history of PAPS labor record is a little spotty, right? And during the sales in the 90s, we saw the brewery close in the city and a lot of workers lost their jobs. But also we saw that retirees, you know, lost their promised health care plans, and we'd like to see that fixed. You know, we'd like to see that those workers get their, those retirees get their health care plans reinstated.
And in our last 30 seconds here, Nicole, I want to go to you. What do you think the brand means to Milwaukee? What does Pabst Blue Ribbon mean?
Well, people have a real emotional, nostalgic connection to the brand. But I think the important question is who owns it and who benefits from it? Because if we want to go beyond a nostalgic emotional connection, we need to really, really, really rethink the nature of ownership and the nature of benefiting from these large-scale institutions. And so I think, importantly, the idea of bringing PBR back to Milwaukee opens up this discussion about alternative forms of ownership, including municipal and community-based ownership. And that's where real meaning exists.
Well, Nicolai and Erica, thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
That was Nicolai Chacho and Erica Wolf, organizers with the Bring PBR Home movement.